And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper, still recovering from a very severe back injury, and we hope to have him back soon. Well, joining us now is Community Association Attorney Donna DiMaggio-Berger. She's recently returned to the law firm of Becker & Polyakov as a shareholder in the Community Association Practice Group. She's counseled condominium homeowners, cooperative, and timeshare association boards in South Florida since 1992, and she's very active in CALL, that's an acronym for the Community Association Leadership Lobby. And we're here to take your calls and emails regarding condo and homeowner association questions. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or radio at WLRN.org is our email. So welcome, Donna DiMaggio-Berger, and thanks for coming back. It's been a long time. It's been 2 years.
I know. Thanks so much for having me back, Bonnie.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you. Lots going on, lots of new issues. But before we get to them, tell us about your return to Becker & Polyakov.
Well, as you said, I started, that's where my community association practice first started back in 1992. Just to put this in perspective, my son Ryan was in diapers when I started, and he's leaving for Duke Law School in the fall.
Oh, my.
So I was with Becker until 2007, and then I had my own firm, and I recently came back, and Becker has just grown tremendously. Their platform, 13 fully staffed offices in Florida and offices in New York and New Jersey. So it's going to be a great fit.
All right, good.
Thank you.
And good luck to your son going to Duke. That's pretty neat.
Another lawyer, which is what we need.
Well, good ones we do. So you wrote in April that you were working on an initiative to get community associations ready for this hurricane season. Here we are, 17 days into it. So tell us about it and its implementation.
We actually, at Becker & Polyakov, we have a hurricane recovery team, and it's working on this issue on a number of different fronts, Bonnie, but we are releasing our new disaster preparedness and recovery guidebook. It's really, really important that a community association boards understand the parameters of what they can and cannot do. They are making decisions, preparation and recovery decisions, not just on their own behalves, but on the behalves of all their association members who are counting on them to take the proper steps. So that's a big part of the what we're trying to do, our outreach and our education. We're going to be doing webinars and seminars, and we're partnering up with other people in the industry to get the word out, because it's been a long time since we've had a hurricane.
So you think we've become a little complacent?
I fear that we have.
Yeah. So what are some tips for homeowners to be ready? I mean, other than what we know already. I'm thinking, you know, in South Florida, a lot of people go away for the summer. And I'm thinking about their shutters being open. Are there rules and regulations that determine that they have to leave them closed when they leave?
Sure. In the multifamily buildings, there are often, and there should be, policies where if you're going to be gone during hurricane season, you need to prepare your unit before you go, or you need to have someone who can do that. But certainly things left on balconies can become projectiles. You want to make sure that the units are secure. In homeowners associations, when you've got people who are undergoing renovations, they often have those big waste bins, and those, there should be policies in place to have those secured or emptied prior to a storm. I mean, the good news with hurricanes is we know when they're coming.
True.
Typically.
But what if there aren't policies in place within a certain building to do something like that, to get that bin, that big trash, whatever those are called,
the receptacles
out of there?
It's a problem. Because that's not your property. So if you don't have, and that's what we're trying to teach, you need those policies in place now before you need them.
All right. And what else about hurricanes?
Well, the most important thing for associations really is benchmarking. You really need, prior to a storm, to have good documentation, videos and photos with date stamping. What does your property look like before the storm gets there? And that's very important. After the storm, if you've suffered any sort of losses or damages, you're going to want to go to your insurance company and be able to show what the community and the property looked like prior to the storm. Otherwise, you're going to have some issues.
That's a great idea. So are these the things that you do in these webinars and seminars to get associations ready?
Yes, we're doing a lot of outreach on that.
And how do you find the people you want to reach? I mean, like, I'm thinking, I live in a condo. What if they don't know that?
This program, thank you, Bonnie, for helping. But yeah, it's a great question. You know, we push it out. I do a lot of work on social media, so I get it out through, you know, all the normal channels, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. But it is always a challenge. And we do reach out to the media because it is so important. You know, we have 60,000 associations, millions of Floridians living in these communities. And it really is important that we get the word out that you need to be prepared.
If you want to call, if you actually are on a board of directors in your condo or co-op or a resident or part of a community with a question for Donna DiMaggio-Berger, our expert, please call us 1-800-743-9576 and we will get to your questions and emails radio@wlrn.org. Okay, let's turn to the 2014 Florida legislative session. It wrapped up in May. There were a lot of condo homeowner association bills submitted during the session. Who were the winners? Who were the losers? What happened?
Well, first of all, we are virtually guaranteed every session, Bonnie, to have community association proposals. We have an ombudsman that makes recommendations. We have a division that makes legislative recommendations. We have groups like CALL that works closely with our legislators on these issues. So every year we're going to see proposals. People go to their own legislators with issues, they who live in these communities.
Right.
And typically what happens is all the proposals wind up being lumped into one or two bills. And this session was no different. We did have a bill that was a community association bill that was sponsored by Representative George Moraitis, Senator Jeremy Ring. We had our CALL legislative agenda on there. And we were able to bring the statutes a little bit up to speed with technology. We've got Skype now for the first time mentioned in our shared ownership statute, saying that board members can attend a meeting by Skype.
Okay.
In the past, it was just speakerphone. You know, most
right.
people know what Skype is now. Also, that board members can communicate by email, but they can't take votes by email. A couple other things, emergency powers we just talked about in the aftermath of a disaster. Previously, only condominium boards had those emergency powers. So this last session, we really pushed to have those emergency powers extended to cooperative and homeowners association boards.
Okay, and what was it before?
Before it was just condominium boards that had the ability to kind of be a little more flexible in the aftermath of a disaster when it came to, you know, using reserve funds or calling meetings, things of that nature.
Right, right. Okay, and what about this bill addressing service and emotional support animal requests?
Well, that bill actually didn't pass, but the issue of service and support animals remains a huge one in communities.
Okay, so who, in the first place, I know that there are a lot of animals being designated as service and support, emotional support animals. Who has the authority to designate that these animals are such?
Well, there is a National Service Animal Registry where you can have your animal certified, but basically, how it breaks down in a community association is if somebody is disabled, they have a verifiable disability, and they need a service or emotional support animal as a reasonable accommodation, they would go to a medical health professional, and they would obtain a prescription or a letter saying that they are disabled and they require the services of this animal.
Okay, and tell us about, I can see where there might be some fraudulent designations, but it seems to be that the wrong people are being targeted.
Well, it's a balancing act, and we say this all the time. You've got some people who move into pet-restricted communities because of the pet restriction, either because they have allergies, they have a fear of pets, and they just don't want to be in tight quarters, whether it's the elevator or the common areas, the hallways. So they have bought into those communities with the comfort level of knowing that they're not going to be subjected to that. Now you have other people who have a legitimate reason where they may need a service or emotional support animal. You have a third category, which is people who want pets in pet-restricted communities.
And just do it.
And they believe the way to do this is to go online, get their little fraudulent prescription and their fraudulent certification and put it through. So it's a real balancing act. You really need to rely on experts to help you decide what you're dealing with. Which category are you dealing with?
And tell us about the case as in Sable, what was it, Sable Palms?
Sable Palms is a recent, it is what we say, a classic cautionary tale that you had a board and a woman in a wheelchair with multiple sclerosis, and she had a service animal, and the board pushed the envelope in terms of the documentation that they required, and they wound up settling for $300,000.
And she still has her service dog.
And that's a good thing, because it's a reasonable accommodation for that woman who had a legitimate disability. I would say that if you're going to use an attorney who specializes in association law, specifically in fair housing issues. Perhaps not the retired personal injury attorney from New Jersey.
Right.
No offense to personal injury attorney.
Okay, it's Topical Currents. We are at your service. We do have calls. We are going to get to all of you, so stay right there, but we do need to take a short break. Donna DiMaggio-Berger, partner with Becker and Polyakov and a community association practice where she is a community association attorney. Stay with us, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents, visiting with Donna DiMaggio-Berger. She's a partner in the Community Association Practice at Becker and Polyakov. And we are going to take your calls, 1-800-743-9576. Let's go to Brian, who's been waiting the longest in Hollywood. Welcome, Brian. You're on Topical Currents.
Yes, thank you for having me. This is a small condominium. And water is considered a common expense for on our condo documents. We've got one owner here who's actually on the board who's been pushing to have each unit owner install their own water meters to pay for water individually. Now, we voted against this almost unanimously, but he's still pushing for this, and he's actually gone through the step of actually taking an estimate of his water uses and reducing his maintenance by it because he lives out of town. Is there any movement towards taking water off of common expenses and having condo unit owners pay for it individually?
Hi, Brian. Yes, we've actually seen communities where they separately meter for water and utilities. But, what I'm hearing from you is any owner can raise an issue, okay? But he was voted down. That would be a material alteration of the common elements to require the separate metering. This particular owner was on the losing end of the vote, which sometimes happens in communities. And at this point, he has to live with that. Reducing his maintenance proportionately is not going to fly, which means he's going to be delinquent, which means at some point the association is probably going to want to collect on the delinquency, and he's going to wind up paying more. So, when you are, it's understandable when someone's on the losing end of a vote in an association, but this person needs to, go about it a little differently. Hopefully he can bring it up again, but at the end of the day, if the majority of your members want to keep water as a common expense, that's how it's going to be handled.
Yeah, that seems to be the consensus here. So, thank you very much for your answer.
You're welcome. Thank you, Brian. And let's go to Tom in North Miami. Welcome, Tom.
Hello, how are you guys doing today?
Good, thank you.
Hi, Tom.
Hi there, and congratulations on your new job there at the Becker and Polyakov. The condo I used to live, I used to use those services, and I recommend them. So
thanks, Tom.
Mm-hmm. My question, I'm hopefully not trying to get away from the topic, but it's about something that nobody really talks about in condos, and it's about receiverships. Mm-hmm. Do you have any experience with those?
We do. What is your particular issue with a receiver?
We are trying to get one here, and everybody keeps trying to discourage us from doing so, but we are to the point that we feel that it's the only way out of all the situations that we're in. We are beyond the dogs. We are beyond, like the last caller with the water heaters. There's everything going on here, and we feel that the board is fighting an uphill battle with people who do not understand about finances and things that have to get fixed in the building. Right now we have a bunch of violations, and our elevators will be turned off in September because there hasn't been a certificate in them for 3 years. And so people just don't, they want to get other people on the board that are saying that they want to lower the maintenance. And it's, you know, it's just a numbers game.
Okay, well, Tom, I'm sorry. First of all, I'm sorry to hear about the situation in your community. And, you know, a receivership is always an option. Typically, you see a receivership in two instances. One, where you don't have sufficient interest amongst your own members to serve on a board, so you need a receiver to come in and run the community. Or secondly, when you have such crushing delinquencies that you have a receiver come in to collect rents and deal with the delinquency issue. It sounds like overall you'd need a receiver operationally. And if that's the route you go, communities have done it. I would only suggest you work with your association attorney to craft the receivership order where it makes sense, because at some point, hopefully, your community will return to a healthy, functioning state. And at that point, you want to be able to transition the receiver out of the community and have your members re-engage.
That is the goal. And I thought that the only instance where we could get one was if there was no one interested in being on the board, and I've had my attorney pull other cases in which it's not. So I'm hoping that, like you said, if we go through her and have her design it, that the judge will say yes, so that we can get into a state. Because there are other people who want to be on the board, but they are delusional in thinking that they can lower the maintenance and pay the bills.
Well, you can certainly petition for a receiver, Tom, and work through your attorney and just make sure that the order is crafted in a way, you know, receivership is not a long-term solution for a community.
Right.
You, at some point, you will want to get healthy again. The other option is to try to educate your board. Our firm presents a lot of education, board certification classes. There are other firms that do it. Management companies offer those classes. The ombudsman offers those classes. So, you know, another option is to get your board educated on these issues.
Correct.
Okay.
Well, I appreciate it.
Good luck.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. Bye.
Our number, if you have a question for Donna DiMaggio-Berger about your homeowners association or your condo association, your co-op association, whatever the case, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Email is radio@wlrn.org. And Wendy in Miami has been waiting. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Welcome. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a public insurance adjuster, and I come across this particular problem quite often, and I really don't ever have an answer for it. I have a lot of clients that are in townhomes. However, they are zoned off as a condo association. They don't own their own roof. However, the roof above them is not shared with anyone else, and a lot of the times either a hurricane damages the roof, and they call their insurance company. And obviously their insurance company is not going to cover the roof because it's owned by the condo association. So the insurance company will pay for all the interior damages. Or their roof is leaking so much because it's past its age, and they then call their insurance company and only take care of their interior damages. And they fight and they talk to the association and say, I need a new roof. And the association just kind of ignores them. And they end up pulling money out of their pocket and putting on a brand new roof. And they don't ever get their money back. Even though that isn't their roof, technically they don't own it. They're supposed to maintain it, but they're not supposed to replace it. And when I meet with them, they ask, what can I do? And I don't really have an answer because most people can't afford an attorney to fight a condo association. So I don't really know what to tell them.
Well, that is, and I'm shaking my head here because I've heard that before with some townhomes and the shared roof. The starting point is to take a look at the master policy. The condo association would have a master policy that would cover that roof. I would initially ask to see that policy, make a claim under that policy. Having somebody take money out of their pocket to repair a common element such as a roof is not industry standard, let me put it that way. So, if you have a board that's handling things improperly, you know what the option is? You recall that board and you elect a board that handles things properly. And I know that's easier said than done. But the scenario you outlined, Wendy, is not typical, fortunately.
I see it quite often. And unfortunately, they cannot force their association to make a claim. A homeowner cannot make a claim under their association's policy. Only the association can make the claim. And sometimes associations just say, we don't want to make a claim, we don't feel it's warranted, and they end up fighting with them. But while they're fighting, the roof is leaking, they're getting mold in their house. They're trying their best to protect it, but a lot of people don't have $10,000 to replace the roof.
And that is, and now what you've outlined is a negligence scenario with the board, because the board, you know, their delays have contributed to mold and further damage. So you're outlining a potential negligence claim, a breach of fiduciary duty against the board. But I think your initial statement was many people don't have the ability to hire a lawyer to fight the board, which is true and unfortunate. At that point, I think that, you know, at least there are resources in the state of Florida, including the Division of Florida Condominiums, where they can contact them and start a, you know, file a complaint and start an investigation.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
The Florida Division of Condominiums?
Correct.
Okay, so I tell them to call them and put in their complaint.
Absolutely.
Perfect.
Okay. Thank you, Wendy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
We have an email from Linda, who is in Stewart. She says, we belong to a small HOA in Martin County. We believe that our board has altered dates on checks written to a construction vendor who was contracted to make extensive repairs to our clubhouse. The board voted to approve this on May 1st of last year. The check in question shows a handwritten alteration of the date to reflect that it was written after, not before, the board meeting where it was approved for the first time. Has a crime been committed, and what should our next steps be?
Well, that doesn't sound good.
No.
The first thing, you know, I always recommend that people communicate, you know, rather than leaping to assumptions. There'll be time later for those kind of recriminations if your suspicions are proved correct. But the starting point is to ask, what happened? Why was this dated this way? Can we see the minutes from the board meeting at which this was discussed? That's the starting point. Now, you're in a homeowners association. I just told Wendy about filing a complaint with the Division of Florida Condominiums. You notice I didn't call it the Florida Division of Condominiums and Homeowners Associations. So filing a complaint like that with the division is not a possibility in this particular instance.
Okay.
For a homeowners association. So they're going to want to do a little due diligence, do a little digging, find out what was done, and then their option, quite frankly, is to contact an attorney if they get nowhere and potentially file a lawsuit.
Okay, I hope that helps, Linda. And let's see, I don't have a name on this. What is the HOA documents? What is the liability when an HOA travels under a limited assignment of a master board and has no declaration or bylaws but is a Florida corporation? Do you understand that?
Bonnie, you picked a doozy. You know, I really don't know what the person is trying to say. Obviously, if you are in a, there are some communities, very large communities, that have these voluntary organizations that have kind of taken on a life of their own over the years, and people think they're one thing. They may even think they're a master association or a mandatory association. And when you peel back the onion a little bit, it turns out that years ago it was a voluntary committee that, you know, morphed into something greater. And that could be that situation.
Okay.
If they don't have bylaws and a declaration.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to David in Plantation with an assessment issue question. Okay, hey, David.
Yes, hi. My unit was assessed approximately $3,000 back in 2009. And somehow the assessment was written that we had to pay the assessment by March, or there would be interest accruing. Our association is such that whenever assessments are assessed, it could be a year before we see any kind of work done. So we chose to pay the assessment in full instead of March in October of the same year of 2009. Our balance sheet shows the assessment paid in full. All post balance sheets from the association shows our unit owing zero. Now, 4 months ago, we received a notice from the association that we owe over $5,000 in interest. And yet, no documents have ever been presented to us, like a payment vouchers, delinquent notices, late notices, and as I said, every balance sheet presented to us from the association shows our unit owing zero.
Okay, okay, Donna.
Well, first of all, David, do you live in a condominium or a homeowner association?
I live in a condominium with, I don't know how many buildings, and each building is considered an individual.
Okay. Okay. So, and this, and I'm assuming this was a special assessment for a special purpose that you were, that was assessed back in 2009. You know, there's a couple things. First of all, in order to pass a special assessment, boards have to follow certain procedures, both under the statute and in their own governing documents. So you will need to go back. And by the way, I'm going to urge you to contact an attorney. You know,
I have done that already. But let me ask you, whenever there's a delinquency, isn't during the course of any of that, isn't by law the person have to be notified of late payment and final late payment or some kind of notice before you can go into court and just say put a lien on your unit?
Well, certainly you should be getting notices that there's late fees. Now, you may have what's called constructive notice because your documents, your governing documents, may say that you are subject to interest accruing and late fees. Certainly before somebody can lien you, the statute outlines exactly what must be done to give you notice to be able to show up and counter that. But you do need to work with your attorney on this. If the assessment was properly passed, and assuming it was, and they had the 14-day notice and you were told when you had to pay it, you know, you may have a defense. You may not, but you need to speak to your attorney.
Okay, David, thanks so much.
Okay.
And Pam says, I worked in both condo and multifamily project management. Before hurricane season, we always trimmed the coconuts to avoid them becoming projectiles. I've moved into a home in Palm Beach County with an HOA. The managers told me the HOA does not trim the coconuts and never has. He said I could trim the trees in the common area behind my house if I want to, but at my expense. Is it not the responsibility of the HOA to handle and pay for this?
Typically, yes. Boards are responsible to maintain, repair, replace the common areas. You know, I wouldn't recommend that Pam go and start trimming coconut trees on her own.
Good idea.
It's not good. And if I was the board, actually, I'd make her sign a disclaimer and hold harmless to do so. You know, again, we get back to that whole issue of communication with the board.
Is it not their responsibility to keep the trees trimmed for hurricane season?
Of course. But they may take a different position. They may have, you know, for what they may have been told by their landscaper it's not necessary, that they're taking other steps, that it's too costly. You know, you don't know unless you ask. Again, this boils down to the issue of communicating. By the way, why don't you do this? Were you told by the landscaper it seems like a good idea to do? And also, it's very advisable for boards to listen to what their members are asking for. And, you know, at the board meeting, say, you know, these issues have been raised by our members. Is this something we should consider? So it really is a two-way dialogue.
Communication.
Yeah.
All right. Let's, about hurricanes, let's talk to Mark in Palm Beach Gardens. Hi, Mark.
Well, good afternoon. I just got back in my car, excited to hear Ms. Berger's topic there. I was listening when she was speaking mostly about preparing a property or preparing the community by taking pictures, making records of what it looked like, conditions before a storm, because it is really difficult to reconstruct after a storm. A lot of people's memories can be a real mix-up. I work as a consulting arborist, and there's a lot that can be done with tree surveys, appraisals, hazardous tree reports before and after a storm, and even apropos of the lady's coconut question just prior. And
right.
I think it's great for Ms. Berger to get this out, because it doesn't get out enough until after the storm.
Well, thanks so much, Mark. And actually, what we find is that a lot of times storm damage then becomes lack of maintenance in the insurance company's eyes, as I'm sure you
know. So they don't get reimbursed.
Exactly. So what would otherwise be covered suddenly is, because you don't have the documentation to prove that your community looked a certain way before the storm, becomes, well, you must not have maintained this.
Mm.
So it's not a covered loss.
Okay.
Exactly. That's part of what I wanted to add, is the precaution, or the part that have the community, the condo, whatever, homeowners association, employ professionals to do these assays, and not just my work. Roofs, parking lots, drainage systems are a very big issue. And if they have these by certified professionals, they have a leg to stand on. And I've seen them, you know, the work that I've done, the claim goes through. But if they don't know what it was and it wasn't authorized or by an authorized professional, you're right, they have a hard time explaining what it looked like before.
Well, I think that's a great point, Mark, because what happens is a lot of these volunteer boards get themselves behind an eight ball. They fail to do the proper planning, and then after the storm hits, they rush to repair and reconstruct. They don't do their due diligence. They're signing huge repair contracts without having them reviewed by their attorneys. Mm-hmm. At that point, after the storm hits, you only need to mitigate further damage. So you need to put a tarp up. You need to protect the property from further damage. You do not need to be signing multi-million dollar contracts without having them reviewed.
Exactly. Okay, Mark, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you, Ms. Berger.
Thank you, Mark.
Bye-bye. So, Donna, let's move on to this hot issue of secondhand smoke in condos and co-ops. So how's that being addressed, and can they prohibit people from smoking in their own apartment now?
Well, this is a hot issue, Bonnie. You know, it's funny because there's a case out of California just this week where the board was actually held responsible for not playing an active role when an owner complained about excessive secondhand smoke. And we really are talking about excessive secondhand smoke.
Now, how are they getting it? Through where? Through the ventilation?
The common ventilation. Sometimes the secondhand smoke is seeping out through the doors into the hallway. Sometimes it's somebody smoking a lot on their balconies. So you've got that smoke wafting.
So it doesn't even help to be on the balcony?
Yeah. I mean, depending on where you are.
Right.
I mean, we do have more and more communities that are considering passing a no smoking amendment to their documents, or they can already control it on their common areas. But in terms of the units, that becomes a little more intrusive because, you know, listen, some people, they smoke. They want to smoke in their unit.
And they already live there.
What we are seeing, and this is interesting, is developers are starting to pick up on this. And we've got two new smoke-free communities going up, condos going up in Broward County. So might be the start of a trend.
Yes. Sounds like California a little bit. Okay. Let's take another call. This is from Nil in Plantation. Welcome, Nil. Hi. Is that right? Hi.
Yes. Nil in Plantation. I live in a community where the board recently, at the end of last year, hired a new property management. Long story short, they've taken down our front privacy fences in the units that they felt were rotted. I felt mine was not rotted. I was not warned beforehand that they were going to take mine down. I have complained to the board. The board basically says, if you guys, you know, we're not going to put them back up for a few years because they're renovating the whole entire project in about 2 to 4 years. There's no given date, and that if I want my fence back up, I have to put it back up myself. They're offering some plants, some hedges, as some sort of remedy. I've complained many times when the board said, well, it's their word against your word. He says the fence was rotted. I say it wasn't. Because of my complaints, they implemented a new system so that when they're not sure, we are allowed to say, hey, wait, I think my fence is good. In the meantime, it's been 6 months, many complaints, can't get this new property management, even when there's a new issue, to answer my emails.
Oh, boy.
And the board is, I mean, I literally am waiting like 14 days for response from a new, because I don't want them to put a hedge. I told them what I want in replace of the fence that you took down is another fence. When I asked them, why is it that they can't put back my other fence? Isn't that illegal? And they said because of fiduciary responsibilities, that if the condo, if they do it for me, they have to do it for everybody, and that we have to wait for the multi-million-dollar renovation, which is happening in an indefinite future, and we're paying a special assessment.
Okay, well, Nil, a couple of things. First of all, you know, management companies and managers take direction from the board.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes boards will hide behind that buffer. So it really is the board that's making these decisions. And I'm sure the manager is acting at their direction. So my first question would be, how often do you attend board meetings? Were you aware that this project was going on? you need to look at the governing documents, see how fences, these privacy fences, are treated, whether or not they are on your lot, whether or not they are situated in an easement, and how do your neighbors feel about this? Do your neighbors feel the same way? Are they as riled up about the fences coming down? You know, had you been aware of this? Had you gone to board meetings prior to the fence being taken down?
Yes, I've been there. I've been to many board meetings, and what they said about the fences coming down very explicitly, was if they feel it endangers us or it's a hazard, they were taking it down. However, my fence was one of those fences that was redone a few years back, and I wasn't even worried about it because I'm like, oh, mine is good. I'm not going to take this. They're not going to take it down. I come home before Christmas, the whole thing is taken down. Mm-hmm. And yes, I do agree that the board ultimately is responsible. I've complained to them many times, and unfortunately, it's one of those communities where people don't really attend the board meetings.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the board also knows that, because I've been told, you know, in occasion, oh, you're just one person speaking out. And, you know, that's all it takes
mm-hmm. to make a change. It is all it takes. And I would, you know, keep going to those meetings. You did the right thing with that. Look, sometimes boards, there's a different level of sensitivity. Some boards are very highly functioning. They're very sensitive. They, you know, provide a comfort level and inclusiveness with their members, so people mm-hmm. know what's going on. And others, they may still be well within their rights to do what they did, but they just right. may not have handled it in a sensitive manner. But keep doing what you're doing. It does just take one person to make a change.
And is okay. there like a website I can go to where there's maybe some, you know, not so seasoned lawyers, where, you know, a regular person, I know there was a caller earlier that said regular homeowners can't afford lawyers, and I think the board members and the property management who doesn't respond accounts for that. Is there like a website where we can...
Well, I would urge you to come out to some of our classes. If you go to bplegal.com...
Oh, repeat that, please?
They're bplegal.com, and go to our classes. They're all free, and it sounds like you're an ideal candidate to serve on your board.
Oh, that sounds. Well, I don't know if I want to serve on this board.
Okay. All right, Neil.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you, Donna.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
And we're at your service with Community Association Attorney Donna DiMaggio Berger on today's Topical Currents, talking about homeowner association questions and condo questions. And we'll be right back and take more of your calls. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with Community Association Attorney Donna DiMaggio Berger talking about homeowner associations and condo associations. We have lots of calls. We're going to get to as many as we can, but we wanted to talk about the need for an association's governing documents to be updated. You say, Donna, far too often they're working with a set of documents that are decades old. And so what can owners do about this if their documents are no longer current?
Well, they need to update them. I mean, we see some communities come in, they're like parchment scrolls, and they roll them out. They've either...
On onion skin.
Exactly. Dead Sea Scrolls. They either have way too many amendments, so when you're looking at it, you cannot really follow where you are in any given spot, or they have no amendments. So the documents are 40 years old, and they are just absolutely useless as a guide, as an operational guide. And, you know, okay. the statute, as we talked about when we first started the show, the statute changes every year. So you really do, especially now, you need to take what we call a document audit. I do it frequently for associations. Go through the documents. I don't recommend boards do this themselves. That's another real problem area, is where you get boards who are trying to amend the documents themselves. Mm. And, you know, they're almost doing it in a vacuum. If you don't know the case law out there, you don't know the
statute. So they need the attorney to...
You know, yeah, I know it sounds self-serving, but helping with amendments is one area where you need us.
And what about this issue of condo or co-op boards enforcing phantom rules? Give us an example of that. What do you mean?
Oh, I think I blogged about that once. It's the pattern of practice over the years where they think the documents say one thing and, hello, it really doesn't. So they may think they have a no pet rule, or they may think that they have a head in parking rule, and they may be enforcing these rules. And when they're challenged and someone says, well, where do you get the authority to do this? They come to find out that they don't actually have that authority, that they just sort of heard that from a previous board. So before a board ever attempts to enforce something, the recommendation is identify the authority source before you attempt to do so.
Okay, we're going to have to ask all our callers to keep it kind of on the brief side because we don't have long and we'd like to get to as many of you as possible. But Jerry writes that he moved into a large condo complex in Broward. His wife is a quadriplegic and uses an electric wheelchair. The complex is run by a community council with representation on the board of directors from each condo association, which collects a part share of the maintenance fees. Last year's budget meeting requested that when new vehicles are leased, they be lift equipped. We were informed by both the manager and head of transportation the community does not have to comply with the ADA. That's the American Disabilities Act. Is this true? They're a corporation and many of our condos are publicly rented, both seasonally and annually, so we believe that they're involved in public commerce.
Well, typically when we're dealing with disability issues and associations, we're dealing with the Fair Housing Act, which is the FHA. ADA is the Americans with Disabilities Act, which applies to public accommodations and to the workplace. But in this case, it sounds like, if I'm understanding correctly, that Jerry, they're denying him having a vehicle with a wheelchair lift. Is that what's going on?
Well, that's what
it would appear to be.
Looks like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think I would refer them back to the Sable Palm case that we talked about earlier.
Okay.
And tell them to tread lightly. That board, anytime a board is met with a request for a reasonable accommodation, that is, again, one of those times where they're going to want to reach out to experienced association attorney and say, what do we do with this?
It says recreation and transportation services are provided as part of the maintenance fee. However, except for a single lift-equipped jitney that only provides in-complex transportation, all of the buses, both large school bus type and jitneys, are not accessible.
Okay.
With the lift.
Well, if that were my client, I would tell him to look into making those lift equipped for a lift.
Okay. We want to talk to Michael in Delray Beach, who's been waiting, about Master Docs for Homeowners Association. Go ahead, Michael. Welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for taking the call. I wanted to clarify the email I had sent a few moments ago about HOA liability. The question really went to when there is a master association that has three communities that were all independent communities when they were born by the developer and transferred over to each community. The one community failed to get its own declaration, even though it was a registered community. So the Becker and Polyakov firm, by the way, developed a concept of making an assignment to the master association's documents, their declaration. And the assignment basically gave the authority to this orphan association within the community that they can contract for tree cutting or grass cutting, but that's about all they could do because the orphan community doesn't have its own declaration and its own set of bylaws. It's really handicapped. And that was my question as to what is the liability of that.
Michael, how old is the community?
The community is 20 years old.
20 years old. Okay. Well, it's a complicated situation. I would have to see why the assignment was done rather than creating a set of documents. I don't know that you're necessarily precluded from creating a declaration for that what you term an orphan community. But I would suggest that the orphan community discuss it with their association attorney now to discuss creating potentially a set of declaration and covenants and restrictions.
Well, we have members in our current community that are objecting to go ahead and approving a declaration should one be developed because they're saying, you know, it's not broken. Don't fix it. We're traveling under the master association's declaration and bylaw.
And you feel otherwise, obviously. So
that's my question. Don't you suggest that each association should have their own declaration and bylaws for whether you're a rule breaker or you're in arrears?
Well, sometimes in communities, the sub-associations do defer to the master association, where the master does take on the lion's share of those enforcement responsibilities. And it's really not for me to substitute my judgment for your members' judgment. It really is your community. But again, this gets back to overall, how do we change things in associations? And we change them by getting enough like-minded people to insist on it. So in that orphan community, if this is something that you feel strongly about, I suggest you lobby your neighbors and make it happen.
Okay, right. Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And just one more call probably is all we have time for. Livia in Miramar, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. I have a situation where at a board meeting it was discovered two separate accounts, not a part of our regular operating accounts at all. And when presented to the board, where did you get that? They just got up and walked out, did not adjourn the meeting.
Well, that's a red flag, Livia.
Oh, big time.
Okay, so
on top of that, the law firm that the other caller mentioned, they're very well known for recalls. But anyway, that law firm happens to be the board's lawyer, which should be my lawyer or our association's lawyer. We have spent over $15,000 on a recall. They have to, you know, pay to defend the recall instead of stepping down. And there's no money.
Right. Well, and that kind of harkens back to our other caller who had that issue and was talking about a receivership. A couple different things. Sometimes, you know, boards do not use any of their expert professionals, so they're not necessarily telling their management company or their attorney or their accountant what they're doing. So sometimes there's the feeling that the professionals are assisting with this when they may not even know what a board is doing. And typically, you know, boards who may want to push the envelope a little bit are not always going to reach out and say, hey, can we do this? Because they're pretty well know what the answer is going to be. In your case, a board gets up, walks out, and you have some issues. You're a condominium, Livia?
Condo homeowners, townhome.
Okay. So you still have that same option to reach out to the Division of Florida Condominiums, the Bureau of Compliance, and file the complaint. In terms of the recall, as long as you have your recall papers in order, even if the board is fighting it, you're going to prevail in arbitration. So, you know, good luck with that, and just keep pushing it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much, Livia. And I guess we have time for one more call. Let's see who's been waiting the longest. Let's take Michael in Delray Beach. Michael, welcome. We just have about a minute for you.
Okay, so my issues are the degree to which the Florida State condo owners and other groups like that promote and encourage solar panels in a state that's drenched with sunshine. I don't see a whole lot of that as a way to save energy and cut down on costs. That's the one question. If you have time, I'll ask you a second one.
Well, okay, let's...
Was there a question, Michael?
Yeah, what's
there?
The question?
Do you see a movement toward that on a statewide level of that group that you referenced that you advised some...
Well, there is a statute, Michael, that says associations cannot restrict people who want to use energy-saving devices such as solar panels, such as clotheslines.
Right. I'm not talking about restrictions, and that actually brings up my second point, that there's so much arresting and violations of trespassing, and there's such a suspicious, a fierce, it's like the Trayvon Martin culture permeates in condos. That's another issue.
Okay.
I'm talking about promoting and encouraging,
You know what I would recommend, Michael? I recommend you meet with your local legislator and bring this up. They're all home now. They're all back from session, and this is a great way to bring up this issue.
And it's a great issue. Well, we want to thank Donna DiMaggio Berger. She's a community association attorney and partner at the law firm of Becker and Polyakov, and as always, it's been a very enlightening hour, and the website there is bplegal.com. And your blog?
My blog is Condo and HOA Law Blog, and thank you so much, Bonnie.
Oh, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate you coming in. And thank you. That is our program. We apologize to the callers and emailers we couldn't get to. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from our online producer, Paul Leary. Free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more info, photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Tomorrow at this time, we provide live coverage of the Miami-Dade County School Board meeting. And we return on Thursday with investigative reporter Nina Teicholz. She's written The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. Bonnie Berman, thanking you for joining us and wishing you a great day. Stay tuned for Here and Now up next from NPR News.